Okay. This is Nora Tai. Today is February 11th, 2025, and I'm conducting this oral history interview for the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. I'm recording this interview by Zoom video call on the campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, with Professor Carolyn Woods Eisenberg, who is joining me from Brooklyn, New York. So, yeah, Professor, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, happy to do that.
And before we begin the interview, I'd like to just mention a couple of your published works, just for ease of reference in case they're brought up later in the interview. So, Professor Eisenberg's first book, which was published in 1996, is titled Drawing the Line: The American Decision to Divide Germany, 1944 to 1949. And then her second book is titled Fire and Rain: Nixon, Kissinger, and the Wars in Southeast Asia, which was published in 2023 and won the Bancroft Prize in 2024. So, just to start off, I'd like to ask, when and where were you born?
I was born in, I have to stop, 1945 in the Bronx, which I still have the accent from.
And what was your specific birthday, if I may ask?
5/5/45.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in the Bronx in New York?
Well, really, we only lived in the Bronx for about 5 years, and then we, like many millions of other people, we moved to the suburbs. So I would say most of my growing up was really, in the suburban setting, which met, fit with a lot of things that people say about the suburbs in the 1950s. It was new. A lot of Americans, if they were white, were experiencing a lot of upward mobility. And I mean, one thing that was interesting at that time was to afford a house in the suburbs was possible for a very wide range of people. You didn't have, I mean, I think about what housing's like now, which is a nightmare. But back then, there was a lot of new housing. People had GI loans. Numbers of people on my block were, had union jobs, so their income was actually pretty good. So there's a little bit more economic diversity in the suburb. But anyway, that's where I grew up. I have basically, I mean, like when you're growing up, you have all sorts of experiences, some good, some bad. But I would say on balance that it was a happy time. And actually, even into my old age, there are friends that were my friends back, like way back then, who are still my friends now. So that's kind of a nice thing. And I think very often now young people don't have any of that continuity for various reasons.
And who else was in your family? Did you have any siblings, or were you with your parents?
I ha so my mother and my father, they had met in law school. But for the time that I was growing up, although my mother was an attorney, and I think always think she was a better student than my father. This was the 1950s, so she didn't work for a lot of our growing up. And then when she finally went back to work, she initially substituted in my junior high school because that was the least disruptive. And it really wasn't until we were mostly all gone or, well launched that then she began to, use her legal education. So she wrote law books for a while, and then actually, when she turned 70, she opened up a practice, which was a little odd. But anyway, yeah, I think it reflected the fact that she had actually not used those skills, in all those other years.
Interesting. And do you think what your parents did, their focus on law, influenced your interests at all, or were your interests entirely different?
I think what, I mean, just as far as going to law school is, my entire life, people would say, "Oh, you're going to be just like your parents, you're going to go to law school." So I had X that out, right? As even a, that was off my radar. So God punished me because two of my three daughters are lawyers and my son-in-law is a lawyer. So we're kind of like, "Oh my God." So I definitely ruled that out. I actually think I was very fortunate. I mean, not that I had the most perfect parents in the world, but they were interested in a lot of things. And my father in particular, had he not been poor, I think he had maybe been a student of Henry Steele Commager, and Henry Steele Commager said, "Why don't you go forward?" And my father didn't have money, and it seemed impractical. But he had this interest in history and also foreign policy. And actually, that was a very important thing. So I was like that nerdy kid that, for example, when the Suez Crisis happened, and I was probably 11 or something. Like, my father was glued to the television watching the Security Council deliberate. And I watched that with him, you know, and he would explain to me, this is the Russian person and this is, you know, whatever. So that was like, you know, I would say I was very lucky in that way. And I mean, my parents were really intellectual, but like in a really not nice way. I mean, they were just interested in things. And then they were a little bit of a space cadet. Like, I can remember my mother coming in and bringing me one of Plato's dialogues, and I'm like 12. And she said, "I don't really want to read this." She said, "No, you're going to get, just read it. You'll like it." You know, so it was like that. It wasn't like high tone. It was kind of, you know, it was kind of more mellow. And they were politically, I should add just one other thing that's probably relevant. I mean, these were not radical parents, but they were politically interested. My mother worked with the League of Women Voters on things related to issues of McCarthyism, which was a very big topic at that civil liberties. And my father was a Democratic committee man, and then at some point they both became involved in CORE. So I wouldn't say that they were like super duper like political fanatics, but it was in the household that was definitely present.
I see. And by core, do you mean the Congress of Racial Equity
Congress of Racial
or
Equality.
Equality? Okay, got it.
So at some point, actually, I mean, this came later. I was actually out of the house by this time, but the schools in our town had been very segregated, so there was, you know, a big effort to change that. And you know, so they were involved in that. I wouldn't describe them as like political zealots, but I would say that they had ideas about how, you know, to live a life.
And do you think their involvements in against segregation in your childhood influenced your interests at all, or did that make an impression on you as you were growing up?
No, it was present, and then actually, I mean, one of the things that happened that was pretty significant was that I had this bee in my bonnet when we didn't ha I didn't go to sleepaway camp for most of my life. I was home, but when I was 14, they said, "Okay, there's money, you can go to sleepaway camp." And then I had this bee in my bonnet, which is that I didn't want to go to a segregated camp, and so I wanted an integrated camp. But you know, actually, there wasn't that there weren't that many. And my cousin, whose family were really radical people, they might have even been communists, I am never sure of that, but my cousin went to an integrated camp, and my mother, you know, thought, "Okay, well, your cousin goes to one, go with your cousin." I don't actually think that my parents realized how radical this place really was. You know, it's just like, "Susie's had a good time, you'll have a good time." So, you know, that was a place where I really met a whole bunch of teenagers who really were very political. And so that had a lot of effect on me. And a number of them, you know, various people's fathers had been in jail for Smith Act, and various people's fathers were civil liberties lawyers, and you know, so there was like a whole and other union organizers. So I met people that were a little bit different than my, you know, classmates.
I
And it
see.
was integrated. So civil rights was the topic that people were concerned about.
And when you reference the Smith Act, is that the 1940 Smith Act restricting free expression or overthrow of the government?
I think that was the way I actually don't even remember anymore. I think it had to do with being a member of the Communist Party and whether you would you testify or not. And I feel like there were a whole bunch of cases, you know, where people refused to testify and took the Fifth Amendment, but then that wasn't acceptable, and some of them went to jail. And I can't remember. I mean, there were a number of, you know, pieces of legislation, but what I'm saying is, I entered in a world with of people where, you know, that was a part of their lives. Much more. There, a lot of the friends from camp were people whose parents were much more politically left and much more active than my parents were.
When you say politically left, what sorts of causes were they interested in, or what did you end up becoming more interested in this experience?
Well, again, it was more like I found people who shared my interests because I was a slightly nerdy kid. I wasn't super nerd because I actually had, a fair amount of friends. So if you're a super nerd, you didn't actually have a lot of friends. But it was maybe finding more people my age who read books, for example, which I thought, and there was a lot of reading in the summer. There was a lot of sharing of things. Again, civil liberties were a question, so I'm reasonably sure that that influenced thing decisions that I made later. I mean, civil rights was huge. I mean, the camp was integrated. There were, and actually a number of, I remember, two black sisters from Mississippi who were there on scholarship. And where we had lots of conversations about what the situation was. And there were some other, people my age who were, maybe their siblings were already getting arrested in Georgia. I mean, the sense of the civil rights movement being very close at that camp was much more pronounced even than, whatever my parents were doing. And the other thing that was very, I mean, two other things. One was, not just civil rights, but labor, because a lot of the kids in camp, their parents had been organizers of major unions during the 30s and 40s. So the labor thing was a very big deal. And then finally, there was a foreign policy interest as well. In terms of, sh nuclear issues, that was very big. Like why was We ha why we were having a nuclear arms race like that wasn't a good thing. Relations with Russia and hardline treatment of China. I mean, these were all things that were getting talked about. And although there were individuals in my school that were also interested in these things, this was like much more intense, of meeting a whole group of kids my age who cared about this.
And when was this? Was this during high school or before high school?
I think it was 1959.
Okay. Nice.
So I think I was maybe in transition from junior high school to high school. It was around that time period.
Okay. And so by the time you entered high school, did you have an idea of what you were academically interested in or a career in mind, or was it up for anything?
Well, I had a lot of interest, so it wasn't, one thing. I was certainly very interested in history. I guess one thing that had started, and it actually started even when I was in ninth grade, was anti-nuclear test ban organizing. And students in the high school, I feel like this started before I was even there, but students in the high school what had organized a sane nuclear policy youth group. And that was very, and they were resisting when there were civil defense drills. Like people were like, "No, we're not doing that. It's making us have the illusion that we're going to survive a nuclear holocaust. That's stupid." So that was already in place in high school, and I feel like by the end of junior high, I was already in that. And so that was a pretty big issue. I would say the critical issue in that was really a nuclear test ban, because this is when there was a lot of scientific, findings which were showing that these bombs that were getting tested, in Nevada were killing people, that the level, entering the milk supply, that the level of cancer was very high. So that organizing had already started in, even before I had set foot in high school. That was already taken. That was a whole culture in and of itself.
And were there any extracurricular activities that were particularly memorable or that you were interested in high school?
Well, I was interested. I was a debater, you probably tell. And I actually, by the time we were senior, I was in charge. I was like that. They all like it was a big joke. Everybody kept calling me the boss. So I was like the head of our debate club. I actually was not an especially good debater, but that was a big activity. And it was funny because, I mean, this is just idiosyncratic, but when I went to high school, all the principal and all these various officials had all been warned that I was coming and that I was like a menace. I was never told that until many years later, that that was the case. But anyway, they were people were warned. The principal was told never let her near a school paper. But weirdly, paradoxically, everybody then wanted to get to know me. So actually, contrary to what, and the head of the newspaper kept saying, "Why don't you work for the newspaper?" And I said, "No, I'm never doing that ever, ever again." But weirdly, in high school, it kind of was a favorable thing. People were really interested. I got to know everybody. I had good faculty friends. The principal, who was like a right-wing person, though, but still, like, she had reached out, and so we kind of became so. All of the stress that I had experienced, actually as a younger person, when I was really like in trouble, actually kind of wasn't true in high school. It was like much more benign.
And so, do you think they were right to warn that you would be a menace in
No, it was stupid. I
on the other
mean,
end?
that's kind of the point. I mean, like, so supposing in junior high school our newspaper had had an article about UNICEF, like, really, was that like some, the things that they were trying to ban, and I do think it's relevant lesson for today, but the things that they were really alarmed about were stupid. And it actually, what would have happened if they just left me alone was that it would have been a good paper. That kids who really like to write would write. And we'd have interesting articles, and we could all have lived happily ever after. But that's part of what political repression does, is that apart from closing out debates that people really need to have, it also actually, just prevents things that don't have that political edge, but good things to happen. And I think that even in terms of Israel Palestine again, I mean, we would really benefit at our school for having more cultural activities about what's going on in Palestine. Nobody would be the worse for that. But there's such a tightness that that's not quite happening.
And so you felt that tightness as well in your high school experience?
Pardon?
Did you feel that tightness as well in your high school experience?
Well, you see, also, that was when times were changing. I mean, there were some experiences that were like this. So, for example, one of the things in the olden times was you have civil defense drills at school, and the siren would go on, and you put your head on a locker and pretend that you were safe. So that became a point of protest. And again, that had happened even before I entered high school, that there were students who were saying, "This is stupid, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to do it." There had been protests. So then, when I was in that high school, because then I became part of that older group, and so did my friends, many of them. So, like, I remember we made blue armbands, and that said, "Civil defense is no defense." And the principal, I guess, went ballistic, and teachers went running around, like, ripping the blue things off of students' arms. So that was very unfortunate. And anyway, so I think I ended up the last person with a blue armband. But it's funny, like, one of my friends, he and I together were like with our blue armbands, and we're in the principal's office. And my friend Peter's parents called. I told him to take the damn armband off. And so he did. So I was the last person with an armband on. And, we're still friends. Like, we're talking about things that happened like 60 years ago. To this day, whenever we see each other, he has to bring this up and explain that his father did the right thing. It's like stayed with him. We have to go over that again. How did his father did what he did? How did I feel about what he did? He was like, "No." So that, it wasn't totally free, in the high school, but it was better. I mean, the atmosphere was better. And I mean, one of the things that happened is, do you know the folk singer Pete Seeger? Does that mean anything to you?
No.
He was a very famous folk singer back there.
Okay.
And he had been called before the Senate Internal Securities Committee, and like many other left people, refused to answer questions. And so he had been cited for contempt, which again, many people had had that. So unknowingly, our high school had made a contract with him at a student's suggestion that he was going to do a concert for us, and then it was before the scholarship fund. So that was going along merrily. And then the American Legion heard about it, and they, had a whole thing in the paper about how this communist was coming to the school, and they were going to picket and blah, blah, blah. So that became like a big upheaval. And I always remember, so I was in conversations about that with the principal, who I actually did come to like quite well. But she was like on this thing. She said, well, she wanted to call him up and ask him if he was a communist. And I said, well, he might be going to jail because he doesn't want to say that in the Senate. Do you really think you're going to call? And he said, hi, Pete, are you a communist? Like, no. But what did happen is that Pete Seeger's agent said, well, if they canceled his contract, that he was going to sue our high school. So he came, and then he had all these patriotic songs that he always sang. Anyway, we all sang, This Land Is Your Land, whatever. But a larger point is, I think what was happening in those years is that the effect of McCarthyism was really beginning to, there was more relaxation about things all around, because a lot of people think that McCarthyism is like him as the senator, but he was just the face of it. There were all kinds of, repressive institutions, and the kinds of incidents, like I'm telling you about, not writing about UNICEF, was happening all over the country. So people were really, for a long time in the 50s and into the early 60s, people really were afraid, and institutions were afraid. But it was definitely thawing. I would say by the time I graduated high school that the atmosphere was not as frightened as it became later.
Nice. And I'm curious what you wrote about UNICEF. Was it related to communism at all, or was it just
No,
other
it was, it was just
you?
the UN, because back then, I mean, what could be like more wholesome than UNICEF? People going with orange things. But at that point, like, I think the sponsors, they were, first of all, they were excessive, right? I mean, this concern was absurd. But they're thinking UN, internationalism, Russia, there's going to be something the matter with it. And that's what I'm talking about, the level of fear. I see that look on their face, that something would appear in the Benjamin Franklin Junior High School newspaper that would get them in trouble. Right? That was the issue for them.
I see.
And
So
also that if I was willing to do that, God knows what other things I would write about. So this fear, I mean, it's a terrible thing.
when they objected to your paper, did it ever end up getting published, or did that?
No.
I
No,
see.
they just made it the same old boring paper it was going to be in the first place. So their idea of a newspaper was that you would have every article would be about with the names of all the kids that were in clubs. Like, oh, the soccer team has blah, blah, blah. No, it just became as boring as it was in the first place, But honestly, the takeaway, well, it was rough for me as a kid. I mean, actually, that year was hard. No, I mean, it was not nothing. But I think these kinds of things on many different levels of society were happening to people for lots of different reasons. Teachers in classrooms being afraid about what they, what would be said. Oh, I actually have something interesting I will tell you about this. You may want to get past my childhood, but I will tell you a very interesting thing that happened, and this does have to do with repression. So, ninth grade, we're asked to do, yes, this was also ninth grade. We're supposed to do these projects, like about countries or, kind of current events things. And we're supposed to clip newspaper articles and whatever. Anyway, I had this bee in my bonnet, which I already had had anyway, which is probably being a journalist, that I thought I would really have a much better paper if report if I went to the Cuban consulate. So I think we're talking here, might have been 61. That would be a good idea. And this was just at the period where the US relations with Cuba were falling apart. And I think actually the recognition of Cuba, I think the US had cut off relations, but the US by treaty has to let the consulate be in, can't interfere with the consulate. So Cuban consulate is in New York. So my friend and I go to, we make an appointment to go to the consulate for my report. And this is actually incredible. And I should tell my class, so go to the consulate. It's dead. Like nothing is happening because they're being isolated, right? So, they're just there. And we were ecstatic because we were two junior high school girls and there were two college boys there who were also doing reports. And they have nothing to do in the consulate but talk to us. So we are there the entire day. And what, or it felt like it was the entire day. And they are telling us that the CIA is destabilizing their country, is doing all of these things to make their, to make the Castro regime look inept or weak or whatever. And for a part of the time that we're all there, they're bringing out pictures to show us of like factory, I'm trying to remember, factories that they say that the CIA had sabotaged. They also said that the CIA was sabotaging their transportation system, that buses had blown up. And they're just going on and on. It's just like an endless thing of like what they say is happening. The US is trying to overthrow Castro and they're doing all these things. So we're just sitting there, like they're just telling us this. And I guess we had pictures that they gave us. So the four of us walk out, it's like dark. And we're like freaked out about what they've told us. And I just remember us walking through Central Park, the four of us. I mean, and we're like saying, what should we do? Like, is it true? Are they lying to us? Are they really gonna blow up? Or is the US blowing up fact? You know what I'm saying? Like we are like in shock. So anyway, my friend Anita and I in our junior high school class decide we're gonna tell the class what we learned at the Cuban consulate and show some of the pictures they had given us. And what we were gonna say was that we didn't know if it was true. That we, as given everything, we were not in a position to make a informed assessment of this. But we actually thought it was we were pretty flipped out by hearing what they had to say. And we wanted to let the class know that this is what they'd said, and they could, people in the class could just, take it or whatever. So we give this whole thing, and then the teacher calls our parents, predictably, and says, he knows that neither of us is a communist, but he's very concerned that other people would get that impression. And so he thought it would be in our best interest if we would stop talking about it. We kind of did. And then, so I can't remember if I was, I don't think I was at Dartmouth then, but I go on to teach American foreign policy. And Nina, my friend, is a journalist for KPFA. And the church committee comes out with this report, a zillion years later about the CIA. And it was just what they told us. It was just what we, it was worse even about all the time they, how they tried to assassinate Castro and they poisoned his cigar and all the, and we called each other. I was like, oh my God, that's so weird. Like they were telling us the truth. Like, oh. So that I always tell my classes about. So that's another indication of, I don't know how much you want to spend of these years, but it's another indication of like what the atmosphere was at that time.
And just to go back really quick, what was your friend's name? The
Anita Frankel.
Anita. Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. And just to move forward towards your experience at
Okay.
Chicago, Yeah, how did you end up there? Were you considering other colleges or what inspired you to end up at UChicago?
Well, how I ended up there was that I was on four waiting lists because I was a mathematical moron. And so, I had those 650 math things that were not good. So I had, all these good things that I, good grades in history and whatever, but I was like a disaster in math and chemistry. And so I was like a waiting list person. I mean, I'd gotten into Wisconsin and I was fine with the idea that I would go to Wisconsin. I wasn't like that disappointed. But I, you could exactly see how they were thinking about it in the admissions office. So I got into Chicago, like in August. I was the last person to be admitted. And hilariously, because I was very active in Chicago and a lot of political things, every now and again, the director of admissions would remind me I was the last person to come in. He'd go by something. I have this vision of him going by saying last person. That was why. So I went to University of Chicago. It was an incredibly political time there. I mean, one thing which then does relate to later is that there was a very active civil rights core chapter at Chicago. And actually that Bernie Sanders was there as a student. He was actually there. He graduated the year just before I came, but he actually, I think, had been head of CORE as a student. And so that, there was a lot of stuff around civil rights, a lot of involvement. The University of Chicago is like this little island in the South Side. So it was like, it was ghetto on both sides. And the school segregation was absolutely horrifying. There was just like a lot of involvement, with that, with the issue of desegregation. I mean, in general, what was really great from my point of view about being in Chicago was that it was very easy to get involved in things in the city, that you were not, the campus really, faced out into a larger thing. And there was just a lot. I remember my first, quarter at Chicago, because we run that same crazy system you are, is I remember that, like going, doing a whole research project on like the Daily Machine in Chicago, which was pretty fascinating, and working for reform candidates. So there was a lot of things to do. And then as well, there was a lot of, I would say by 64, 65, it was anti-war activity. And that was a very big part of the college experience. It's not like it wasn't necessarily everybody, maybe it wasn't even a majority, but I would say the issues of civil rights and the war in Vietnam in particular, were very salient. They're very central to the college experience. And then I also was, we had something called the student, I forget, Student Political Action Committee, which, was like a lot of people. At one point, I was the head of that. But it was a very, it was a very interesting time. Again, nothing's perfect. I'm sure you've noticed that in your college experience, that everything doesn't go well. But, it was really a, it was a growth experience, and in many ways. And then there was this other funny, odd thing, which was that Kennedy was assassinated at that my freshman year, and the
That
vice
was
president
1963.
in November 63, and one of the people that had been Kennedy's legislative assistant in the House of Representatives became the vice president at the University of Chicago. And he was very interested, he was like a shill for Bobby Kennedy. He was very interested in like making connections between active young people and people who had been part of the Kennedy land. And I think it was partly because that's what he knew about. But it was also partly because the question of Bobby running was always floating around. So weirdly, he reached out to a lot of student activists, including me, know, so like we're invited to these events with Ted Sorensen and Pierre Salinger, and you know these Kennedy kind of never, actually never Bobby. And then finally, so that was like interesting. And then the third thing that was really interesting was that Martin Luther King came to Chicago because he wanted to do a project in a northern city that, you know, it was like a experiment. And so he came to the university. I think I was a junior then. You know, and he was partly there to get students involved with his effort. And he came to campus and he gave a big speech. And then that created a whole series of open housing marches in Chicago, that he was involved in. And then when he left, his lieutenants, Jesse Jackson and James Bevel. So again, like that was pretty, you know, it was pretty exciting and dangerous. But one thing I often have like discussions with my students when we're like learning about this period, which I think is really different for them, is that in that time period in the 60s, people who were involved in these larger projects were reaching out to students. You know, it wasn't like we're sitting in our dorms and saying, oh, well, gee, I'd like to meet Dr. King. You know, he's there. Bayard Rustin was there. You know, numbers of people from SNCC, and they're coming to talk to students, and they're inviting students to participate in things. So that's a very different mental situation. You know, I think about that a lot. I don't think my students have anything like that, of being recruited, you know, and made to feel important, which I think we all did. We were a little crazy, but we had that feeling.
And when you say SNCC, is that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating
That's
Group?
the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And they had there was actually a branch in Chicago, but they were basically, most of them were in the South. So, but what they did was, so my junior year was like Mississippi summer. I don't know, does that ring any bells for you?
So yeah.
Right. So they were recruiting college students that summer to go. And so they were up at our campus, you know, doing that. Now, if you wanted to go to Mississippi summer and do voter registration, and you were not 21 years old, you had to have parental, you know, permission. So I actually wanted to go, but my mother's view was not over my dead body. You're not going. I'm not signing. No. And then when Schwerner and Cheney and Goodman disappeared, I don't know if that resonates to you at all, because we were still in struggle about whether I could go or not go. But then these three civil rights workers disappeared, and their parents were on television, and my mother was saying, "I'm not going to be that woman. I'm not going. You can't go." But other students did. And so again, there was a very vibrant sense of, you know, they went for the summer. A bunch of people did, came back. You know, had a lot of complex experiences, but it really infused the campus life, I would say.
I see. And this is the summer of 1964, the Freedom Summer also, right?
Right. That was 1964.
I see.
And
And sorry, yeah.
no, but they came out, you know, this was like a common thing. You know, my boyfriend, who subsequently became my husband, was a student at the University of Michigan. And in 1965, when there was all that stuff happening in Alabama with Selma and people getting beaten up on the bridge and marching to Montgomery, very similarly, you know, SNCC kids arrived at the University of Michigan and said, "We need you to come march with us." And so people got in their cars, including my then boyfriend, and drove from Michigan to Alabama. And we're part of that. But again, I'm very mindful of this because I feel like my students don't have anything like it, you know. And I don't even like sometimes to teach about protests because I feel like it makes them feel like they're losers. And I keep wanting to say, you know, no, it was different. You know, people invited us. You know, we th so that you know, it's a different time.
And do you feel like back then it was easy to join a protest, or did you feel scared at all about the danger of being a part of that?
Well, it depends what the protest was. There were a lot of, I mean, there were a lot of Vietnam things. There were, various civil rights things in Chicago. What was terrifying was when Martin Luther King came to Chicago, a big focus of his activity was open housing. And they were marching through, these white neighborhoods, mostly white working class neighborhoods that were like really, racist, and no black people could be there, and that's what they were doing. And so that summer, like, there was enormous violence. For if you were marching in those places, in those neighborhoods, the violence was huge. And it was terrifying. And actually, so I was in Chicago that summer because I was like trying to pass biology, and I was in danger of never graduating. So in terms of those marches that were so dangerous, like, I had all these excuses. Like, if I go in this march, I'm going to fail biology. It's no joke. I have to worry about biology. So I'm in constant, like, stress. But I did go on one of them, and it was terrifying. But it's also, I learned from that. I mean, the level of hatred from these teenage boys, and then these white women on their stoops that are screaming and cursing. And in Chicago, as opposed to Mississippi, the police did actually, they were providing protection. So, like, we're marching, and they're, we're two abreast. And I'm marching with this black woman who seems to be about 85 years old and enormously more brave than I am. And so it's two of us abreast, and then there's a cop on either side. So you'd think that's pretty safe. There are like bottles flying, bricks are flying, people are spitting, cursing. I'm terrified. And this woman, I'm holding her hand. I'd always remember this. I'm thinking, what's wrong with her? Like, she's not afraid. Why am I afraid? And she keeps saying, don't look at it. Meanwhile, I crash. I just don't look. Look straight ahead. Don't look at them. Keep walking. You're not looking. Remember, you're not looking. It's nothing's gonna happen. You just yeah, so that I have that memory of that march, but I've never forgotten the hatred that was there, and the hysteria actually of people. And then you had these boys like with their motorcycles, and they had Confederate flags. You could have been in Mississippi for that situation.
And which summer was this? Was it
That
still?
was in that summer. So it must have my summer, might have been the summer of 66. I think that's when King came to Chicago, and I think that's when I was failing biology, which was like more important.
And before we move on to your time at Columbia, I just wanted to go back and check. I missed, you mentioned something about your mom warning you not to go to the Mississippi Summer Project because of the disappearance of a few activists. Was that James Cheney and
Yeah.
Michael Schwerner, and the third one was,
Andy Goodman.
okay, and Andrew Goodman. Yeah.
Because what was happening that summer, I couldn't go without my parents' signature because I wasn't 21. So we were fighting about it. But students were going down in waves to Mississippi. It wasn't like everybody is like in one trip. And actually, Andy Goodman, no, I'm sorry. Mickey Schwerner had been there. He was a little older, and he had actually been in Mississippi for a while. Andrew Goodman disappeared the first day that he was in Mississippi. And James Cheney was a black young man from Mississippi. So the three of them had gone to inspect a church. They were arrested. They were let out of jail at 10 o'clock at night, and then no one ever saw them again. So it was pretty clear that, they probably had been killed. And so, in terms of my ongoing struggle with my parents, my mother, that because we were still arguing about it, but once those kids disappeared, like, my mother said, there's no way, I will never sign you to go. Don't go. And truthfully, I was relieved. I mean, it was, doing these things is not like you just, oh, this is fun, I'll just go. It was scary. It's just that you felt that it was the right thing to do. And one thing I was talking about with my classes sometimes is that a lot of the civil rights activity was initiated by Black college students and Black high school students. And that was not lost on us. And so you're sitting in the University of Chicago and you know what's going on, in Alabama, Mississippi, because it's a lot of information going back and forth. And so there's like a part of you that you're seeing that these black students are doing this, and you're sort of saying to yourself, well, why sh they're doing it, like shouldn't I do it, like, right? What? So again, it's a very different context, I think, from now, in terms of the clarity of certain things.
And yeah, I guess that's a good segue into your time at Columbia. Before we get into the occupation, how did you end up at Columbia? What was your thinking there in terms of pursuing a master's degree?
A PhD. Well, that choosing ended up because I was getting married, and my husband and I each applied to 10 graduate schools, and I actually got into Harvard, and he didn't, and so he got money from Columbia, so that's what happened. So I actually came into Columbia. I didn't have any financial support. That's what I'm telling you. Don't make that mistake. But at that time, so I was there for you. I didn't have financial support, but then I got a fellowship at the end of my first year. So I wasn't that miserable. I mean, there was this little part of my brain, like, gee, too bad I didn't go where I was getting money and could have been important. But it wasn't the most horrible fate. So, that was a good choice in terms of academics. I mean, there were lots of interesting faculty, et cetera. So, I mean, the big news for us was we were married. It was 22 years. We were 22 years old, and we're like, suddenly we're a married couple on the Upper West Side. Like, that was weird.
So this is in, you arrive at Columbia in 1967, is that?
Correct.
Okay.
And he's in the philosophy department. I'm in the history department.
Sorry, I missed, what department was he in?
He was in philosophy.
I see. Okay. And did you have an idea of what you were researching in the history department at Columbia?
But that's partly, I think I was saying that to you earlier. Like, I didn't have, and this I don't think I was different from a lot of other people. I didn't have a professional identity. Like, I wasn't thinking practically, like, you need to. So what happened, and this does have ramifications for Dartmouth, is like, I didn't have, at that time, if you were going to get a PhD, you had to do a master's first. So I didn't even have in my brain, oh, well, what I do my master's on is going to like slap me and I'm going to be this kind of person or that. I didn't have that. So I decided to do this master's thesis on the fight for community control of schools in New York City, but it's particularly in Harlem. And I was very interested in that because what I was interested in was the fact that many of the people who were pushing for community control of schools and black principals and the whole thing were people who had fought for integration. And I thought that was really, and in Chicago, the things were still at this integration stage, and I had been somewhat involved in that. And so I was really just interested in understanding what had happened. Like, why, what was that about? So when I picked my master's thesis, I didn't think, oh, I'm now going to be an ex-historian. And somewhere in my brain, I actually think I was thinking that I would be go back into foreign policy, which I was really interested in. So I worked on this thesis with just because I was interested in it. And then I learned a lot. Like, I spent a lot of time in Harlem. I got the archives of this group. And as has been true for every project I've ever done, I take a million years to do it. So, like, I took the most time anybody did to write my master's thesis. And then I actually, my plan was to go on and write a dissertation that would be on foreign policy. However, somebody or other in the history department asked other people in the history department if they had read my master's thesis. And then it was said by somebody to somebody, this master's thesis is more like a PhD. Maybe she could just work on it for 6 months and be done. And So that's actually what happened. So I'm in my mind, like, I'm going to be writing about foreign policy and I'm going to be here for eternity, right? And all of a sudden, I'm going to have a PhD. Like, and I hadn't even decided I wanted to be a historian at that point professionally. I just was interested in things. So all of a sudden, then it occurs to me, well, oh, well, if I'm getting my PhD right now, then I actually lose my fellowship. So that, oh, well, oh, I better get a job. So I was 26 years old and hadn't really picked a field, but I got hired by Dartmouth initially to replace their urban historian, although I never thought of myself as that, on a 1 year line. And I guess I had other job offers at that point, but it was fast. Like between the time I knew that I was going to do these revisions on my thesis and be done and got hired by Dartmouth, like all of it was very compressed. And I think it's fair to say I didn't have any personal identity with being a faculty member at all. It was like zero. I mean, it's not that I didn't want to be, it's just like it was like that, I was getting ahead, I was finishing ahead of my friends. My husband was like nowhere in his thesis. So anyway, that's how I actually ended up at Dartmouth. I got recruited. And then I guess they pushed me a little bit. Because I was in contention for being a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Anyway, I sort of, that decision got made in a very snappy way.
And so, just to, for a sense of the timeline, was it in 1971 that you received your dissertation?
Correct. I finished it. They wanted me to do re some revisions. So I did some revisions. Then I actually defended my thesis. I had five people at Columbia that were there. And then they had some people had criticism. So I actually had to take, like, there's a way at Columbia, I don't know if it's still true, that they'll tell you that you passed. But if they tell you need revisions, they want you to do them, and the person that's your advisor has to sign off. So it was a little bit extra. And actually, I don't think I finished it until like maybe the 3rd week of August. I mean, Alan had already moved up to like Vermont, and I was sitting there like still doing it. But everything happened very fast.
And Alan is your husband.
Right.
I see. And so that's Alan Eisenberg.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and so you mentioned Dartmouth, which I'm also really interested in, but before we get there, during your time researching civil rights at Columbia, did you feel like those issues were also present on campus as they were at the University of Chicago?
Well, they were present, although, again, I was really trying to understand the transition from from an integrationist perspective to a Black Power perspective. And that was a very dramatic shift. But there were issues going on about, Columbia's relationship to Harlem. Like, they were a big slumlord, for example. And also, their admissions policy was left a lot to be desired. When I came to Columbia, there was an SDS chapter, which was really made up pretty much of people that were in the col in Columbia College. And that SDS chapter had been around for a long time. There was also student at African, the SAS, I can't remember the initials, which is a Black student.
Afro-American Society, I think. Student Afro-American Society, is that?
Yeah, that might have been what the name was. And that was also mostly undergraduate Black students on campus. So these groups were existing. I initially I didn't have that much to do with either of those groups, but one of the things then that became an issue, I mean, apart from Columbia being a slumlord, which is somewhat of concern to people, is that in Morningside Park, I don't know if you can picture it, but it was a park between Columbia and Harlem. And the park was used by kids from in Harlem. And then Columbia decided to build a gym in that area, which was going to dramatically affect the use of that facility for people in Harlem. So that became a big focal point for organizing. I don't think I was like really that involved on the Columbia campus with that. I think more, I mean, when I was doing the research for my thesis, I was more like interviewing people. And actually, you know, at that period of time, there was a lot of anger in the black community about white people who did research. And that had some other effects, which we could maybe not go into exactly right now. But, you know, I was always getting yelled at when I was doing my research. Like, why are you here? We're sick of white people. Don't you know that you get the message? We hate white people. So it was actually a little stressful. Everybody wasn't saying hooray for you that you're studying this. So I was really more, in terms of civil rights, I was more focused on that. And then, you know, we're talking like 1967, 68, right? So, I mean, the war is really heating up at that. This is really the escalation, certainly in 67. So I think at that point, I was more relating to anti-war activities that were going on off campus until the spring of 68, when everything comes home to roost. But, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on in the city about the war. And I mean, you know, there's a fact that keeps getting stated, which, you know, whenever I say it in class, I see that it doesn't really make an impact. But going from 16,000 American troops up to 550,000 American troops was huge. I mean, the ramifications in the society were enormous. And so the sense of this war, like being like totally out of control, was very profound. So there was a lot of things to be a part of. You didn't necessarily have to be active at on the Columbia campus. So I was doing more things. I went to the Pentagon March, you know, various things like that.
And the Pentagon March was 1967.
Right.
Okay, I
In the
see.
fall of 67, it was huge. It was like, you know, kind of a, it was a bit of a countercultural march because it was this whole thing about we're going to levitate the Pentagon, and people were like chanting. It was kind of like, it was kind of a funny thing. But then the people who stayed, which was not me, you know, oh, into the night, a lot of, there was, you know, police really, you know, were ferocious, and a lot of people got really hurt at that. Could we stop for just a sec?
Sorry, what did you say? Oh, yes, of course. I will pause the recording. Okay, the recording has been resumed. So just going back to your time at Columbia, you briefly mentioned the spring of 68 as a time when you started getting more involved with politics on campus. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and what that felt like or what that looked like.
Well, so what happened in 68 was that one of the things that that SDS in particular had m been raising as an issue is the whole question about the university's complicity with the war and the fact that they were doing research, which they were lying about, for they're literally doing weapons research on campus. And they're meant they the university was part of something called the IDA, Institute for Defense Analysis, which is a whole operation whereby American elite universities are collaborating with the Pentagon. So that became an issue. And then so in the spring of 68, there was like a demonstration, which was originally just like about the gym being built. And about IDA. And then there was like a march to the gym where it was supposed to be built. And that's sort of the way it wasn't, there was no plan. And then people said, let's go to Hamilton Hall. And so then people, again, the leadership of this was very much from the undergraduates and very overwhelmingly male. So people went into Hamilton Hall, and that was white students and black students, and so we had that dual focus. And then somebody had the I, this part I wasn't there for, but somebody had the bright idea of the dean of the college had his office there. Why not lock him in his office? So that had happened. And then people are also thinking, maybe we should stay in this building. And again, I had actually been involved in sit-ins at Chicago, which has some influence on this
Oh,
closing.
sorry. You cut off briefly. I was wondering if you could go back maybe 10 seconds. I just.
And I also, I'm no longer visible either. So all these things happen. Okay. I had had a lot of experience about sit-ins before coming to Columbia, and which was in my head about those experiences. I didn't love a lot of it. I had also been like sort of the chair of various left organizations on campus at Chicago, and I came away from some of those experiences with mixed feelings. But we, that's a whole long story in itself. Anyway, so we're in Hamilton Hall, and I think my husband came in, so we're both there. So they have graduate students there as well as undergraduates. I actually thought the atmosphere was pretty crazy, and I was sort of half being there, not just as a protester, but because I actually was concerned that things were getting out of hand. And one of the things is that on that first night, civil rights people from Harlem, grown-up people, came into the building as well. And the truth is that it really raised the level of anxiety because it seemed pretty clear that some of those people had guns. So it was a very, it was actually a messed up situation. I truthfully ended up staying there partly because I was concerned that people were being crazy. I wasn't there like just, oh, hooray, let's tie up the school. And I was very concerned about the dean being locked up and that that was crazy and somebody needed to try to get the dean out. And also that if people had weapons, they needed to be gotten out. And I sort of felt I was a little bit older. I was also like a TA, so I felt older. And so I was half staying, I would say, to for the reason that that night that I actually felt that this situation was getting really out of hand. And then about 2 or 3 in the morning, the black students said to the white students, "Get out of here. We're gonna run our own building, our own sit, and we don't want you here." So that was like very heavy. I mean, there's a lot to be said about that in general, but about why did they kick out the whites? And there were some good reasons, but the partly what's going on was this whole male thing about like how strong are you, how brave are you, what do you like take, I'm gonna die in Hamilton Hall. It was like a lot of craziness from the beginning. But anyway, the black students said, "Well, to the white students, we want you to leave now, but go take another building." So then some people then from Hamilton Hall broke into Lowell Library, smashed the windows, and went in there, which actually I didn't think was a good thing either, and didn't do it. I didn't go into Lowell. And neither did Alan, and we thought they were being that it was really, again, it was just like too hyper, too crazy. And but then, as this whole protest developed, which was partly about the treatment of Columbia of the racial community around them, and partly about defense research. I mean, I was in sympathy with those demands, and the event expanded so that there were ultimately 5 buildings that were occupied. Which I think hilarious when I think of these administrators, like how going crazy it is, the demonstration for 2 hours, and they're like, wow. And at Columbia, there were 5 buildings occupied, places totally paralyzed. So one of the 5 buildings, which was Fairweather, where if you end up at Columbia, you'll see more Fairweather than you ever want to. That's where the grad students were. So a lot of who was at, I mean, there were others, like ultimately there were 500 students in Fairweather. But of those 500, a lot of them were grad students. And so then, so that building was not crazy. And then what happened was that a steering committee for the whole event was set up. And Ferris Booth Hall was kind of the student center. So each of the buildings had 2 representatives to the steering committee, which met the whole time. And so I was on that steering committee, and I think I was the only woman on the steering committee. And I was older than most of the people, not all of them, most of them. And again, I was suddenly, for me, this was a complicated thing because I totally agreed with the demands. I thought that these young men were actually lunatics and that they were kind of irresponsible. And so some part of me was there for that reason still, that I felt like that there was a need for some people to like try to tamp things down. And then we had a huge fight because the people on the steering committee were in touch with the mayor's office, constantly in touch. And there was a point when it was decided that the police were going to come on campus. And the steering committee knew that, and we knew when they were going to come. And so I said, well, let's go back and tell the people in the buildings. And a lot of the people on the steering committee said, no, that it wasn't being a revolutionary, and that, why did we have to tell people, because maybe people would leave if they knew the police were coming. So I thought that was really not right. I think maybe, we should be more democratic, let people know what's happening. So it was very difficult. That was actually a very, very difficult experience being on that steering committee. And whenever we have had Columbia reunions, I always say that I was the most hated person on the steering committee, and everyone agrees. Like, nobody says, oh no, you got it wrong. And actually, as the head of all that was Mark Rudd, whose name you might have heard as like the leader. He was impossible back then, but we actually are friends. I helped edit his when he wrote his biography. And he actually, I mean, Mark in particular, see, but this is the moment where I mean, what's happening in Colombia, which I did not agree with, was people are moving to, we're revolutionaries, we're going to be violent, we have to smash the state. It's like a lot of posturing. Mark was a, symbol of that. I mean, there was so much wrong with it, I couldn't even begin to say that, what was wrong with it. But then one of the things that happened at Columbia, which for some reason nobody ever really says, which is that when the police came on campus, in a couple of the buildings, people resisted arrest. And when that happened, there was some violence. But mostly there wasn't. Like Alan and I got arrested in Fairweather. They arrested 500 people in Fairweather, many of their graduate students. But like our police officer was actually pretty nice. In fact, he was so nice that when I was in my jail cell, like he at some point came by my jail cell just to say he knew there had been violence. He just wanted to tell me that Alan was fine. That was nice. This never gets reported, but what the cops did that was insane was they beat up the kids on campus. In other words, you have all these students that are not in buildings. They're standing around. They want to see what's happening. The police come like flying through. They beat up everybody. So this was like only a very small fraction of the kids that were hurt were people that were actually in the buildings. It was the most ridiculous thing ever. It's a little bit like Annalise getting dragged, but multiply that by hundreds. So, those of us who were in the buildings were in jail. The campus, the next, I don't think we didn't get out of jail until, I don't know, sometime, like we were there till like the next afternoon. So we missed a lot. But when we came on campus, there were all these students walking around, with bandages and bleeding. And so that turned the whole campus. That was the thing. And so once that happened, the whole campus went on strike. And that basically that was it. I think what happened was that professors were, told to meet their classes, that if classes wanted to continue to meet, that was okay, but that every class should meet with the professor and decide, whether they wanted to meet or not. I actually have a lot to say about that, but I'm going to spare you all of it. So about what how that came down. But in any event, that so the campus was then basically closed. A lot of the Columbia leadership who had been pretty, pumped up, and they went on to, take leadership in SDS.
SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society.
Right, but this is when SDS decided not to be democratic, but they were now going to be f underground, violent, etc. And none of, if you were at Columbia at that time, that happening was no surprise. And it was partly, I think, that development that made me feel, that I should stay in these deliberations because I felt they were endangering other students by their behavior. And then they really ruined SDS. So one of the things, was that they went underground. There were a lot of things that happened. I think they destroyed SDS. So anyway, that's a whole story in itself, but it is very interesting just in one respect, which is, I mean, Mark became very, very contrite about his role, and he's never recovered. He's actually will go to his grave feeling terrible about this. It's not like a little thing. He's very ashamed. And actually, when the stuff was happening last spring at Columbia, we actually talked about it, because he was being asked by the media, especially when people took Hamilton Hall, he was getting a lot of reporters' calls. And he was very conflicted about talking to them because he felt like, he just didn't feel like he should be an authority on anything. He felt like he really behaved very poorly. I like him a lot. I feel like he's, I feel like he's, a very sensitive, thoughtful, older person. Anyway, so, but the thing that becomes more relevant to you actually is that one of the effects of all that in 68 is that graduate students got really organized. And so we had a graduate history union that was created then and that was operating for the rest of my time in grad school. And it was a lot of political involvement. And like Cambodia was a very big moment. And so one of the things for me, my orals was scheduled like about 10 days after, or 5 days after the Nixon announced that he was going into Cambodia. And of
Is
course,
this
the
in
meet
1970?
1970, it was spring of 1970. And so partly, it was a big issue for me because I was like in this graduate union and I'm thinking like, we want people to do stuff, which mostly was going out into working class communities and talking to people. That was what we were doing. And I said, I'm going to sit in, the library and study for my orals. Like, that's terrible. So I called Richard Hofstadter, who was chairing my committee at that point, and I said, I'm just going to delay my orals till September. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm not going to study for them anymore. And I don't want to do badly, So we agreed on that. And then what happened was that he called me back like a day or two later. He said, look, this is really stupid. If you don't want to study, don't study. And just come and do it. And if it's bad and you fail it, then you're not going to be in the same place. You'll take them in September, but who knows, you might pass it. So what then happened in the interim was that Hofstadter got very sick and rushed to the hospital right in that time period. And I had my orals in fair weather, and I had the worst orals that anybody has ever had. I felt like nobody could think of a question that I could answer. It was like, I really was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Who was our first president? I don't know. So I did pass no matter what because they knew that, whatever. But I would just say the whole time, to sort of slightly round this up, is that, really from 68 right on to when I left in 71, the graduate students were really organized. And, and there were very good friendships that came out of that. Because, like, for the whole first year I was at Columbia, my husband and I, we were from New York, so we knew people. We made no friends. We had zero friends because Columbia was so impersonal.
Oh, sorry, you cut out again. Okay, I've resumed the recording after some connection issues. So you were talking about how Columbia is quite impersonal and how the graduate student body became more organized. Is that right?
Not just organized, like we made friends. I mean, one thing was that, and the graduate students that were arrested, which there are quite a few, were initially threatened that they were going to take our fellowships away. And so that was a whole question about what would we plead guilty, not ple so I don't remember any of the details except that it meant that we had a lot of meetings. And that would be graduate students, not just in history, but in anthropology, sociology, you know, whatever. So there were those kinds of meetings. So first of all, you met a lot of people that way. But the other thing was that a lot of the history students also, we had our history, graduate history union, which we'd had for 3 years by that time. And maybe not, but from 68 on till the moment I left, there was that. And so that was really great. You know, we had arguments, but first of all, that was, we really made friends. And I'm still friends with people, you know, quite good friends with people who, you know, who are part of that, including a person that I met in jail who I had never met before. It was a place to meet people. We're both up against the bars of the cell. And you look familiar. You look familiar. So it turned out she was in European history. And so we got to know each other, and then we became friends. And she's still like, I do a lot of stuff that's related to peace, you know, stuff, especially around Israel, Palestine. And so that particular friend that was like, I met in literally in jail, you know, she's still in all those groups. But, you know, that, I mean, I guess I want to say two things about it. It became a way to have friends. We also had study groups that were outside of the regular curriculum. It was a guy from Princeton, Arno Mayer, who was very famous and who died fairly recently. And he was like very interested on the connection between social history and foreign policy and military. He was like an integrated thinker. So like he just like we just had a seminar with him that wasn't a seminar. I mean, we just like met with him. No, every week. So it was a very vibrant time, really. I would say in the history department, I'm sure it's nothing like that now, but that's what it was. So that was kind of background when I went to Dartmouth. That's what I was in, right? So, you know, politics were big.
And speaking of politics during the time, the Kent State University shootings were quite significant, which I think occurred in 1970. Did that affect the atmosphere at all?
Well, first of all, it affected that I had the worst orals than anybody ever had. That was that.
Mm-hmm.
The campus, there was a lot of political activity on the campus. Faculty were furious about that decision, you know, at a university. And so there was even like organized faculty protests. But the political action that people did was not directed at the university, which is very different from 68. And again, like the history students, for example, we decided to go door to door in a working class community and talk to people about this. And that wasn't so unusual. My husband is in philosophy at that point. Like, you know, they also went to some other community that the philosophy students did. So it was kind of a sense at that point that it was important to just talk to people about the issue. So I feel like that's what we did. And that was interesting. I mean, I remember one thing, the history students found this kid who was AWOL, who was in the military. I remember I wasn't the discoverer of this, but others found this boy and he was terrified. He was AWOL. He didn't want to go. And, you know, God knows, you know, and people then, you know, connected that kid up to, you know, attorney and got him some, you know, kind of help and backup. So there, there was a lot of activity, but it was kind of off campus. I would say that was.
Let's see. Okay. And so I guess we can move on to Dartmouth now. You arrived there in 1971, is that? Or
I arrived there in
19.
1971,
Okay.
and I'm coming out of that. Okay, so that this probably could make a little more sense. Like, it's a very political campus, and more to the point, actually, was I wasn't thinking like a professional. Like, I didn't come th this is very different from it would be now, even. Like, I didn't come, first of all, I didn't even have a field. Like, I never decided I was an urban person. I was going to write about foreign policy. And I was so oblivious that I didn't even know when I was in the history department, for example, I was hired on an urban thing. But I wanted to teach about foreign policy. So I just did. Like, it never occurred to me that that could be a problem. And probably the person who was very boring who did teach foreign policy was probably furious. But I don't think, I wasn't thinking like that. That's, and the other point I would make on this is that I wasn't alone in thinking it in this different way. I was not the only person, young person, that was coming there who, like all of us, that in this sort of cadre of people, were really interested in working with students and really interested in doing, good classes and high quality classes and having lots of discussion. So it wasn't like people were like, oh, I don't care where, I'm just gonna goof off here. There was not any of that. But it was not thinking in a professional way, like, what do I need to do to stay here? And then nobody really mentored me. Like, for example, I like my idea is that, you may know this, which is, at a university or anything, you have to be on committees. That's like part of your service. Well, if you're going to come up for renewal or you come up for tenure, what's your service? Like, so I'm like put on these committees, and I think I'm in like a club. Like, oh, do I think this committee is interesting? No, I don't like this committee. It's like, and nobody, like, I didn't get the memo. Like, you don't act like that. I was really, in some ways, really out to lunch. But partly the other half of that, which is relevant to you and your project, is that to some significant degree, Dartmouth was affected by what was happening in the society. Right? So, like, if I had arrived there in that state of mind in 1959 or 1989 or something, it wouldn't have been even passable behavior. But, Dartmouth was I think there was first of all, there were things going on campus. No, right? There had Parkhurst had happened.
The first occupation in 1969, is that
I think that's when students were arrested. I think that was pretty serious,
right?
maybe more serious than anything. So, to some degree, both with respect to faculty and with respect to students, there, Dartmouth was being affected by these currents that are flowing through, the country at this point, and I think that to some degree, I mean, people might differ about this. Like, so Alan is writing this dissertation that looks like it's never going to get done, but he's writing it. And, I think when we came, he had long hair, I had long hair. I think people were really eager to meet us. Like, people weren't unfriendly. I think people thought we were kind of cool, which we were amazed at. I have to say, like, oh my God, how weird is this? But
And is that related to your participation at Columbia?
yeah, and the whole thing, I mean, we were coming out of this whole culture that was developing, and to some extent already existed at Dartmouth. It wasn't like, but I would say there was more receptiveness to us personally, and not just like personally, but even open to things that later would have been unacceptable. Like, I never graded people for ex I think I mentioned that to you. It was like,
And what was the reaction
Well,
to?
see, but here, but see, this is really more about Dartmouth, so we should, give it credit here. So, this is the period where there's all these alternate ideas about education, right? I mean, that's kind of in fashion. And actually, I had been grading Columbia students, so that was really a big experience. Like, I from grading Columbia students, I had decided that I never wanted to grade anybody ever again, and I thought it was really stupid. And I could tell you more about that, but you'd be here till midnight. But just to say, I had very firm views. So pretty early, I don't even know if I did this right away, but like maybe second quarter, I said in my classes, I said, look, I really think grades are stupid. And I really want us to learn together. So here's my deal. You have to, if you're in this class, you have to hand in all the work and you can't cut class. If you come to all the classes and you do all the work, when the term ends, give yourself whatever grade you want. Just don't bother me about it. Huh? So what I'm trying to tell you is that there's at least six other people on campus that were doing the same thing. It wasn't just me being weird. So one thing you could probably, I mean, we may have talked about this one in pre-interview. I mean, one thing that was actually pretty fascinating is that except for one class that I taught that was actually it was not a good class. I mean, it was my fault. It wasn't their fault. But the students did an unbelievable amount of work. I mean, it wasn't like people said, oh, good, she's kind of this lunatic and teaching my class and I'll never do anything. That it actually was very, very motivating. And I think for all of us who did this, that we had very similar experiences, that the level of participation and engagement was really excellent. So at a certain point, so what I'm telling you is, and I have to say, nobody ever said anything like no one in the history department's like, what, are you crazy? I was like, can you imagine somebody coming in now and saying, don't bother me, give yourself whatever grade you want? And but what's very interesting is that somewhere, enough people started doing experimental things, in that general area, that a couple of people, I keep thinking of Rogers Elliott, who I don't know if he's even alive anymore, but anyway, Rogers, people started getting freaked out about grade inflation. Because one thing that was happening was students were giving themselves very high grades, which I didn't really care about. I just wanted them to do the work. And again, I'm saying me, but this was not just me. So there was then this reaction in the faculty about how is this going on? And then there was a fake thing, I think it was totally fake, that Harvard Law School had written and said, we're never taking anyone from Dartmouth because your grades are too high. I truly think that was fabricated. But in any event, so it came up in the faculty that there should be a crackdown. And what was really interesting, I was trying to find this, and I don't, you know, I couldn't do it quickly, was we wrote a grading report arguing that grading was really stupid and anybody with a brain in their head knew it. And that they should not try to impose uniformity, that people should be allowed to do whatever they wanted. And I think it's true that 20 faculty members signed that. That's why I can't, but it was a lot. Because I think I was telling you in our pre-interview, I'm pretty sure Jim Wright signed it, who was then an untenured professor. And when I got rehired to come back as a visitor, he was the dean at that point. And so, I mean, we were actually quite friendly. And he said, you doing your crackpot thing, And I said, you signed that report, that crackpot report, whatever. But I'm telling you that little incident because it does tell you something about the atmosphere at that time that I think it's unimaginable. And my school would never tolerate. I mean, Hofstra would fire you in a minute. Like, that's not, No, it's not okay. But so I guess what I'm trying to say is that in this time period at Dartmouth, there were student political groups, and there was more openness. So after I had been there, I had come in as a visiting professor in urban history. One of the things that was also really interesting at exactly that time was that there was somebody in the admissions office who was a Dartmouth alum, a black guy, who had made the case that Dartmouth should recruit from the inner city, that they should go night throw away their usual recruitment plan, and that they should contact guidance counselors in inner city schools and have them identify students that they thought were promising and just bring them to Dartmouth and give them full scholarship. So because I was officially the urbanist and I was teaching stuff in urban affairs, I had a lot of those kids. I don't know if we talked about that at all, but anyway, like from the South Bronx, the South Side of Chicago, Jersey City, Newark. I probably, because I taught urban courses, had a larger proportion of those students. And of course, they felt like they had landed on Mars. Right? I mean, I just remember, I might have told you this, but I remember this kid who was in my class, Ricky. And he's in my class, and it's just about Thanksgiving. And I remember him sitting in my office and saying, "I'm going home for Thanksgiving. I live in the projects, and my mom is on welfare. I don't even know how to tell her what I'm in." He said, "Do you understand how?" I mean, a lot of the, I talked to a lot of those kids, and it was very challenging for them to be there. But one of my questions, actually, which has not been answered, I know that later that the view at Dartmouth was that this approach was wrong, and that they shouldn't recruit in that way. But one of the things that happened that was really weird was I was in Washington and in Union Station. And this man calls out to me, and I turn around, and it's this very, very niftily dressed man with a briefcase. And I look, and it's Ricky Jones, and he's a lawyer. And I was like, oh.
So this is years after.
Like a million years after. And I then heard it from another student who I think is like head of the MTA, like he's head of Port Authority now, who's another kid who, was really had a terrible high school background. So I've always, and who now has vast authority and like an important person in the Port Authority. I've always wondered about how the line at Dartmouth was that this was a failure. But I don't actually know if it, I mean, I've always wondered if that's really true, and what the evidence was. I really don't know.
Interesting. And so you mentioned that the general atmosphere of the campus was very experimental at the time. Do you think that affected at all the anti-war activities on campus or the acceptance of those or reception of those activities?
The atmosphere was totally different about that. So, I mean, first of all, like in Reed Hall, which is where the history department was, which was quite different from Carson. I mean, there was a ton of people. Reed Hall was like very, I'm talking about Reed Hall when I was there the first time because I came back. But the whole atmosphere was different anyway. I mean, faculty was there, there was a lounge. The place had students all the time. I don't think that was true. When I came back, that wasn't true. And, a lot of the students who were hanging around were, well, some of them were, some of them were these black kids who were like felt like they were in Mars. A lot of the more political kids hung around, but not just them. So just in terms of even student faculty relations, it was very informal. And I don't know if it ever was again. I mean, you might have a better sense of that than I do at this point. There was an expectation students would be in our house. People were in and out. It was a much freer atmosphere. And I would say that in general, that, there was more receptivity to protest. I don't think it ever happened that anybody ever said to me, "Don't do this." I think that the closest, and I probably mentioned this to you, was when we had this, demonstration, civil disobedience of faculty in Lebanon. And that was a faculty, I mean, there was a decision. We were going to get arrested. It was also a decision not to have students be in, get arrested with us. That felt really irresponsible. And so, because we got arrested, I missed my class. And so the guy who was acting chair then did call me in about that. And he told me, ex kid was really mad and didn't feel that I was fulfilling my responsibility. So he said that. And maybe he said, "Try not to get arrested that often." Do you know what I'm saying? It's like that.
I see.
Comparing to what there is now, it's really different.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I can't remember if I told you this when you did your pre-interview, or even when I gave that talk, or you weren't there, but in 1972, in the spring. So that was my first year there. And, one of the things is also that, so I came in as a visiting professor. And I wasn't like feeling desperate to stay. I had various other job offers. I was really, so I wasn't like on edge about it. But like very, pretty rapidly when I was on campus, the government department was going to give me a regular contract. And then, because the government department was going to give me a regular contract, the history department gave me a regular contract. So nobody said, "Oh, this person is too weird. Let's just go. We want to rid of." And one thing is that I think I told you this, I asked not to stay. I said I didn't want a contract renewal. That was not a hostile thing on my part at all. I really just wanted to be doing something different. And there was also a factor of my husband. So I never faced the question of, like, would I be reappointed? And it could be that I wouldn't have been.
Do you think? Oh, sorry.
Never crossed, I didn't think, what planet are you on? But my immediate experience was being welcomed and supported. That was really, and but the reason I raise it is because I do have these other friends who are fired who are excellent. They were not renewed or they didn't get tenure. So I don't know. I mean, the history department, was a little bit more liberal. But I don't know what would have, what would really have happened, but what I am saying, this was very hospitable. I really was left free to do whatever I wanted. And it was pretty stimulating. I mean, one thing about my teaching that is very different from now is, like, I had this course that everybody called Atrocities. It was like from Hiroshima to My Lai. And that course was just like full of bad news about everything. Like everything terrible that had ever happened, was in this class. And you know, that could, like, I wouldn't do that now, even with Israel Palestine. But in a way, it was more reasonable to do it back then because the students had all absorbed the official truth about history. Their high school history had given them a set of ideas that were already there. So to introduce something deviant was sort of bouncing off what they had learned before. So it didn't feel like you were just brainwashing them. You know, it was good discussion. And there too, I mean, nobody, you know, I think there was this cranky guy who had been head of history named Lou Morton, who was long gone to his reward. And he got mad because in one of my courses, I assigned it Peyton Place because I thought it was culturally, this was a great, you know, thing that, you know, had sex in it, and that was unusual. No, so he complained about that. But what I'm telling you is there was an openness. Oh, and what I started to say was, so moving along to 72, when we had this, you know, a lot of protests, not just there was protest at Crell, there's a bunch of things.
Well, is that
The lab, something, is a chemical.
the engineering research lab in Lyme, New Hampshire?
Right. And I think, I don't remember exactly, like there was a damage. I feel like there were people that got arrested at Crowell. Also, I didn't because one of the professors, Marisa Navarro, was in my car and she was getting her citizenship just then and she really did not want to get arrested. So I remember that we drove off. But I think people were arrested there. But with this faculty arrest, something I didn't know till I was doing research in the archives is that the Ivy League presidents, including John Kemeny, went to Washington then. They asked to see Nixon, and who didn't want to see them? But they met with Henry Kissinger, and I have the transcript someplace. It's probably somewhere with my grading, with the grading report. Is they all of them, and the president of MIT, they were really pressing Kissinger that they have to stop the war because it's ruining their campuses. I
This
mean,
is
it wasn't the most
a
inspired message. There could be other reasons, but you know what I'm saying? But it was very clear that they were feeling the pressure, and they were, I mean, think about that as opposed to what these college presidents have just done, right?
And this was after the spring of 1972 that they wrote this letter.
They didn't just write the letter, they went in person.
I see.
And then they stayed and they lobbied Congress. Like, none of us knew that at all. But I, you know, it's become relevant because, you know, it's, this is a very different situation. You know, they weren't that idealistic. It wasn't like they were saying, like, things like, well, you know, there's a lot of people that were killing for no good reason. Like, they didn't say that. They said our campuses are disrupted. But nevertheless, the effect of the protest was not to have them crack down on the protesters, right? It was to put pressure on the policymakers. So that was a kind of interesting, that was something I didn't know at the time. I don't think anybody really knew.
Interesting.
You know, but it was a different atmosphere. And the other thing was that, I think I had mentioned to you also that the spring of 72 was significant because that moment was when large numbers of troops, North Vietnamese troops, came charging into the South. And it was really a shock because the Nixon people had managed to convince themselves that they had solved the problem. And then all of a sudden, there are like hundreds of thousands of troops coming in. And they're quite afraid, actually, that the other side's going to win. And so their response to that was to do massive bombing in you know, Hanoi. In Haiphong. And they hadn't really done that kind of bombing in cities as up till that point. So there was an emergency faculty meeting. Maybe there was even more than one about what should Dartmouth do as an institution, and should Dartmouth cancel classes? And it's possible, I don't know this, but I wouldn't be surprised if Dartmouth also canceled classes during the Cambodia invasion. I literally don't know that. But so there was a big debate about that. And I just remembered this one person saying that he took inspiration from the fact that when the Germans were bombing London, that the people in London carried on and did their work. It's just like silence. Like, who's going to tell him that the British were not bombing other people? They were bombing, right? They were being bombed by somebody else. So, like, no one wanted to be the person to say that. So, but the debate in the faculty was really about literally canceling classes, and I think the decision was that they would leave it up to the individual professor. They did not want to do a college-wide thing. And then this faculty action that I'm telling about, I can't remember the order, but like that faculty action of trying to block this draft bus was that was in the that like kind of happened in the history department. Like we were I remember that we had more than one meeting in the history department lounge of faculty, not just history people, but other people, to talk about what we should do and what would make sense, and to figure out like the plan. And big topic was what about students? And that's what I'm telling you, there was a decision that you don't want to encourage students to run that kind of risk. So that, that was a whole other thing. So there's like a subset of faculty that were very involved in an ongoing way.
So this is, and just to get the details right, this is May in 1972, and there is a bus going to a center in New Hampshire for with draftees inside the bus. Is that right?
That was about, the whole thing. I mean, to put it in perspective, though, we all said we're going to butt it because it was a draft bus that would leave from Lebanon. Now, to put it in perspective, the I don't know that we exactly knew this, but like the draft bus was like Omar's taxi. It was not. It was like less than advertised, or two or three like lone people from Lebanon would be in the taxi. So I don't know if we really appreciated that it was a taxi, but the decision was that we were going to sit in front of the bus and not move. And therefore, it seemed more than likely that we would get arrested. And I think I was mentioning there is an article in the New York Times which seems to describe that there were 1,000 students there. I have like no memory of that. I do have a memory of the taxi. And it wasn't nothing. I mean, so Al and I had been arrested at Columbia. But we, it wasn't like we just said, oh, that this is a big nothing. Like we, it was ner you know, it was really scary. And I keep wanting to say there were like 20 people that were in jail. And I may have mentioned to you that my husband got a job in jail. Did I tell you that?
No,
Oh, that
you
was a little nice thing. He was trying to change, his thing was he was getting his degree in philosophy and he was trying to change careers to being a psychologist person. And in order to make this change, he needed to get a job. But, in psychology, he had to show something, that he wasn't just a philosopher. So, he had written, I don't know how many letters to like local groups offering to work for them. Nobody wanted to hire a philosopher. But when we were in jail, like the head of the mental health center at Dartmouth was in the cell. And so this is really true. I'm not exaggerating. And so, we have a lot of those of us who didn't know each other that well. I mean, mostly we knew each other, but like we didn't know him, for example. So it was an opportunity to get acquainted. And so Alan was explaining to him about how he was a philosopher and no one wanted to hire him. And so the guy who was head of the mental health center said, "Oh, well, don't worry. When we get out of here, I'll have to hire you on an orderly line, but I'm going to have you trained. And then you'll be able, if you're applying to a graduate program, you'll have had supervision and stuff." So it actually worked out very well. And I had this, one of the funny things is that when I was in Vietnam doing research, they seem to like, if you want to do research in Vietnam, they check you out. So I like had made many requests, and they seem to have looked into us. So I guess that people in Vietnam knew that we had been arrested, maybe once, twice. They seemed to know that. And so when I was going to my various interviews, a couple of times I had the experience of like these Vietnamese people saying, "Oh, we're so grateful for the sacrifice of you and your husband." And I'm thinking, really, this wasn't, this is not like what it means to be in jail in Vietnam. Like, my husband got a job. I felt so ridiculous saying this. Anyway, so that was part of it.
And do you think the for the other faculty that also participated, was the mood similar, or was it, were they also slightly fearful, slightly
Yeah, of course we
understanding?
were all fearful. It's just a thing to get arrested. I mean, unless you're really like crazy. And then we got arrested, and then I forget what we were accused of, like some petty crime, but criminal trespass. I sort of, my arrests get confused. But Jonathan Mirsky, who is one of the people that organized this, he actually, I was trying to think of who was the person. He actually brought some like major person who had been part of the Johnson administration to our trial in Lebanon, because every case of all the arrested people had never been able to include in the trial testimony about whether the war itself was criminal. And therefore, somehow or other, people wanted to make that case. It never managed. And so Jonathan made like a whole thing about, and I'm blocking out who it was, but he got this top official to come and testify and say basically that we were trying to, we were trying to avoid criminal action on the part of the US government. So the trial got like bigger thing, but I don't feel like anything ever happened to us. And I think I might have mentioned that there was another group of faculty that got arrested in the fall.
In the fall of 1972, is that
Right.
right? Okay.
And Leo Spitzer keeps saying that he was saying that, I think he felt like the charges got dropped, but I'm not, that's, I don't know if you knew him, but he was in the
Yeah.
history department for decades.
Yeah, I think he mentions
Did you inf
his charges
interview?
becoming unconstitutional. We've interviewed him for the project.
Right. So they were like our friends, to this day. Right. So there was another, wave of protest. I think there was a lot of feeling at Dartmouth, and I think it was through the faculty and to some extent even some students, that there was all this activity that was going on around the country, all this resistance, and that Dartmouth is a little bit of a backwater, and there was kind of a desire to be part of it rather than the opposite. And one other thing I would just also add in this thing, I get a little bit mixed up between when I was there the first time and when I came back, but there were conservative students at Dartmouth, and by the time I came back, there was a Dartmouth Review, and people had really bad experiences. But I would say, with the exception of one person who gave me the worst write-up ever in the teacher evaluation, totally horrible. I actually found the conservative students to be perfectly relatable. I didn't find them rude. I didn't find them disruptive. I felt that they contributed to class discussion. And I maybe it was clearer to me when I came back because people were really upset about the Dartmouth review. But I would say that was not my general experience. I felt that, people might disagree, and the campus wasn't that conservative. But even for kids who were, I feel there was an openness to discussion.
And so back to the, I remember you mentioned that there was a debate about whether or not classes should be canceled. Did that end up happening, or did the faculty?
It didn't, except a bunch of us were in jail when classes were supposed to happen. So that was like an interruption. I actually can't tell, remember, there was certainly no policy decision. I mean, that was what was debated in the faculty. And the conclusion was that the school was not going to shut down, which maybe had happened during Cambodia. And maybe there was a general thing that people could make a decision of their own.
And what were the general attitudes of the college administration? Did it feel like they were being receptive to all of this activity on campus?
I didn't re remember that I'm like the most marginal person you can imagine. I'm just like, I always think that I was 11 years old and like, why am I there? But I really had no contact with of any substance of with the administration. What is the case is that my friends were fired. The biggest one was Jonathan.
Professor
And
Matt.
it was so monumentally stupid. I mean, it was just a terrible decision. And truthfully, the history department was somewhat complicit in that. I mean, I forget exactly how the vote went, but then the case went to the administration and to Leonard Reeser, who I think was dean of. He was like the third in command. I forget what his title was. And he was terrible. And Leonard was actually terrible. My friend Joan Smith, who was in sociology, she was also like not given tenure. I mean, that's the way it happened. I mean, Jonathan didn't get tenure and Joan didn't get tenure. And these were le ridiculous decisions. And the if my knowledge is that the administration was very unhelpful. In both of those cases, and who exactly? I mean, the sociology department, I think they were more, well, I was going to say they were worse than the history department, but I'm not sure that's true. So those are the two people that I knew that actually had to come up for tenure and, really should have gotten it, and I mean, Jonathan was just a terrible loss to the school. I mean, I couldn't possibly overstate his influence on campus. He was like this totally committed teacher. He was somebody that students would go there and like they talked to him for hours. As a young faculty member there, when I came, he's like, telling me every 5 seconds, I need to read this, I need to read that. But his sincerity and his commitment was so palpable. I mean, later he became pretty conservative, actually, when they went back to England. But that was like a tragedy. I mean, it was very stupid. So that's why when I'm saying, like, I don't know if I would have actually survived, but it never came to that. And, I think there was bad feeling. That was there because I think people in the history department felt, or a lot of them did, that I had gotten great treatment, which was true. And like, why would I leave? It seemed like very ungrateful. And I might have been somewhat obnoxious at the time. I wouldn't rule that out as a possibility. So when I left, I felt that there was bad feeling that I left. And I never came back on campus for 10 years. And then I did.
And so, speaking of, so you leave Dartmouth in 1975, is that?
Yeah, that's my last one.
And you end up for a short time at CUNY University in New York.
I end up with nothing. I end up with, I've been hired, and I still remember I was sitting in Silsbee, and you know, it's hard. I was expecting to start in 2 weeks, and every single person in CUNY who was hired knew for any of the CUNY schools that we all got axed. So that was not the moment that I was going to go back and ask the history department to extend my time there. That did not feel right. And so then I had, you know, that takes up a lot of time. I had, you know, a period which was kind of a struggle. And it was complicated because one of the other issues was having kids. And I really wanted to have children. And I also didn't want my career to like prevent that. So I had a lot of some different po I had to scramble for a while, and I had 3 kids in that time period, you know, after leaving Dartmouth. But I, you know, and then the job market was much worse, so it was somewhat in that context that I came back as a visiting. First, I came back in MALS, in the MALS program,
Sorry, in the what program?
Master of Liberal Studies. Do you know what that program is?
No, Master Liberal Studies.
If
I'm
you look
sorry.
in it, you'll see it. There's a master's program at Dartmouth in liberal studies.
Okay.
And it's people getting their master's in mostly interdisciplinary work. And various people in the history department, you know, taught in that. So the first time I came back in that program. But I went right back to Reed Hall. So it was like really weird. It was like being back. And then everybody was nice and friendly. I mean, some new people had been added, but a fair amount of people I knew from the first place. And then nobody remembered anything. Like, how did I leave? What happened? It's like nothing. And we also had 3 kids at that point. So even when I started teaching in Miles, I was back in Reed, so it felt completely familiar. And then I was asked to be a visitor in history, and then I actually got offered a full-time job at Hofstra, so I took it because it's New York.
And
But
so, just to establish the timeline here, was it in 1988 that you returned to
I
Dartmouth?
think it's when I came back. It's a little blurry, but I think it was probably around then.
Okay. And then 1990, you arrive at Hofstra University.
Yeah, or right away. I feel like I got offered the Hofstra job at the same time that I was actually in the history department. And it was a little weird because I did actually feel when I came back that, like, I felt people were really nice, and like people were asking if I would be willing to stay. So again, I might have been very stupid. Like, I didn't feel like that was like impossible. But I wasn't dying to do it, and I had a full-time job in New York, which was excellent. But the other thing I was saying to you is that in all those years, in some of those intervening years, and then even after being at Hofstra, I had this part-time thing that I did almost all the time, and that was that I taught a program, a CUNY program, for adults who had never gone to college. And I can't even think of, like, I feel I want to say I did that for 15 or 20 years. So I did it at the time when I was marginally employed, and then I did it when I was full-time employed. But that was a pretty significant part of my professional life, was actually doing that, which I love doing.
And this was at the Center for Worker
Center
Education.
for Worker Education. It was like a phenomenal place. It was really great. And I was fine just doing this one course. But it was just a really good experience. And I think I told you in the pre-interview, and it's true, is that, you know, apart from these tales that I'm sharing with you, one of the things that really did hang over me from the minute that I had this job at Dartmouth was I was really acutely aware of educational inequality. I spent years thinking about that, both, you know, being involved in Chicago, and then, you know, my dissertation. And I felt like I was in a very privileged place. And it was benign. Like I didn't experience, other people did had found, meanness, but I didn't. So, I wasn't that. It's but I definitely had the thought, especially when I was there the first time deciding about a contract renewal. I felt like I'm like in my 20s, and what are you gonna do with your life? Like, where are you gonna use your skills? And I had that in my head from the beginning. So, a lot of people say, especially sort of left people will say sometimes, oh, you were at Dartmouth, that must have been terrible. It wasn't. It was actually kind of nice. I had good experiences. But I did feel, okay, I have gifts as a teacher. I felt like I was a good teacher. And I thought I should use it, for people who don't necessarily have the same access. So that was no joke. I mean, I had that from the very beginning. And so the fact that I was able, I mean, Hofstra is kind of middle ground, like it's not such a privileged place, and there's more of a mix of kids, but this isn't exactly the most unprivileged people either. But, working for the center for work around, I also did some other things like that. I taught welfare mothers for a while. I actually taught prison guards for a while.
And is this all before you went to teach at Hofstra or during time?
No, I think I did. I'm trying to remember the sequence of this. I would say more of that theory was before I was full time at Hofstra.
So part-time at Hofstra or just
Full
before you
no. When
went?
I went to Hofstra, I was hired full time.
I see, I see. Okay.
Okay. And it was a little bit also. I'd had three kids at that point. When I came back to Dartmouth, was also in the context where my book was book one was being published by Cambridge. So that was, I mean, truthfully, that, from a Dartmouth perspective, that's like pretty good. And so that I was kind of in that. And so then I taught in the history department. I got offered a full-time job. I took the full-time job. I actually kept my part-time job teaching at the Center for Worker Ed. I did that for a long time. That's what I did most. So I had that, and then I was invited back numbers of times in Mal. So I taught in the summer up until 2003.
At Dartmouth?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And
So it's
so,
kind of in and out.
and does it feel different teaching in such different contexts, like at the center versus students at Dartmouth?
Yeah, it's very different.
Is there anything you've learned from?
I've learned a lot, but what I would say, I think, because this is actually something that, if I ever retire, which remains a question, could happen one of these days. I actually, one of the things that I have thought about is actually writing about my experience having taught a lot of different kinds of people at different times in my career. I feel very lucky about that. There were times when I was never sure I was going to, I was in New York. Am I going to get a full-time job? Nobody wants to hire a woman, foreign policy, things didn't always look, that relaxing. And certainly when I was leaving Dartmouth and I just lost my job, like that was bad. It was a definite bad thing. So it's not like everything was hunky-dory. But I feel like the fact that I was able to do a lot of things, and if I ever retire, we might go back to the Center for Worker Ed. That would not be out of the question. So I feel like I've been very lucky because I got to know lots of different kinds of people. What I have learned from it is that, and I'm very mindful of this because my granddaughter's just gone through the college process, so which I think is insane, to be blunt. Is that people's intelligence is not neat. The differences of people's intelligence is not that great. I mean, that, now maybe there are areas of intelligence, like some particular skills like math, and maybe some people really, maybe there's a very big gap. But when you're teaching, in social sciences, you're teaching history, But this vast apparatus of like who's smart, who's on top, who's getting it right, that the differences are not great. And it's very exaggerated. You know, and SATs and all these things, you know, make it seem like it's so very. When I was in my early years at Hofstra, this has changed, but in my early years, I would teach summer session. And at that time, when I taught a summer session, kids who lived on Long Island, right, who needed to make up a course or something, would register. So, you know, in a summer class, like in June, you know, I might have Hofstra students and somebody from Yale and somebody from Swarthmore and some, you know, what submission. And one of the things I kept saying is, I want to have somebody walk into this classroom and listen to the conversation, and you tell me who is the Yale person and who is the Swarthmore person and who is the humble Hofstra person. Can you tell that? You know, because I feel like that's if I was going to say one thing that I've learned, it's not that there are no differences, because in terms of skills, you know, reading, who reads what books before they came to college. I did teach women on welfare, with, you know, obviously the different experience. But when you're just asking a question, you're having a discussion like who, you know, who's the smartest in the room? And by the way, does that matter? I think, you know, that there's like just so much less of a gap, and that people's potential for doing good work, that's a very widespread potential. And the question is whether you have institutions that are making people, you know, get to use that potential. So I actually do think that's one of my, and I periodically think I like to describe, you know, some of the experiences I've had in classrooms. So I ended up, you know, a lot of people, there's like a bad Dartmouth, you know, vibe out there to some extent. You know, it's rich, it's sexist, it's this, it's that. You know, it's, I'm telling you, I know how many times I was there, so it must have been terrible there. No, not at all.
Interesting.
Right? But how different, you know, is the opportunity, are the opportunities that are given to different groups of people? I mean, that's where I think it's really consequential.
And I want to move forward a little bit to your
You're down exhausted yet? I feel like I've never talked so
No worries. Yeah, we're almost to the end.
Okay, let me just get some water. Okay, hold
Yeah, of course.
on.
I'll pause the recording. Okay, so just resumed the recording, and actually I'd like to briefly return to your experience at Dartmouth. And you mentioned that the faculty and students were interacting a lot, especially in the Reed Hall Lounge. And so I was wondering if you could elaborate more on the relationship between faculty and students, and if you have any memories of that in general.
Well, just in terms of it abstractly, and again, I'm not an authority on this by any means, but I did notice from the time that my last class in 1975, and then I was back teaching in this department in 1988 or 80, somewhere in that time period. I did feel that in both cases, I was in the same building I'd ever been in, which was, I kind of liked because I felt very at home there. But I did think it was different. And I think that what I thought was that the pressure on the faculty to be important researchers and be professionally, have a high profile, had really changed relationships, and even people, how often were people in their offices and so forth. You know, it would be a very rare afternoon when I was there the first time, let's say it's 4 o'clock, when, you know, there'd be a ton of people in their offices and there'd be students and you'd be sitting in the lounge, and then people would say, oh my God, we better leave because it's five, it's six. But I'm saying, so it was very fluid. And I didn't feel it was true, but when I came back. And one of the ways that that was manifest actually was, so I taught for a quarter and then several students that I had had in a seminar asked me for recommendations. And I said, you know, I'm kind of the lowliest person you could get. You know, if you're applying to anything, you know, they'll want a full, you know, a regular person, you know, can then say you're the best student they ever met. But a lot of students said they didn't have relationships with faculty. And that would not have been said for better or worse. That would have been very unusual. Back in 1972 or 73, you know, that there was more relationships than you can imagine. You know, and I would say, you know, that I had really good experiences with students. You know, there's some people still, there's some Dartmouth students that I am in touch with still. And even, you know, have had occasion. I think I had mentioned to you John Cavanaugh, who is my student, who got involved through Jonathan. He was got involved and interested in what was happening in Laos, like way back when he was our student. And then John went on to become head of the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a very major leftist think tank. So he and I have actually worked on things over the year, you know, a little bit. And then I'm doing a little bit of work with the Laotian organization called Legacies of War, which John helped found. And was all kind of grew out of his Dartmouth experience. Like he was saying, he couldn't believe that this had come full circle after, you know, so many decades. So, you know, there, I would say I had, you know, lots of good experiences. And when I came back, I still felt the same way. But even there, it was so interesting because I felt like I was getting to know students really fast, you know, when I hadn't been here really. But you know, I feel like it was very valuable. I feel like I learned a lot from students. My first book, which is really about the origins of the Cold War in Europe, I think I had mentioned to you previously, in a way that had really come out of my Dartmouth teaching.
This
And
is
very
drawing the line.
specifically, I had done a seminar like, God knows, like 1973, 74, on the origins of the Cold War and the historiographic debates about the Cold War. And that was just like a really good class, and a lot of issues got crystallized from that experience. So I think it had a lot to do with the way that I framed my research. I mean, I then went on to spend like another 15 years just doing this research, but you know, those conversations were actually pretty important in doing it.
Very interesting, thank you. And so, following your publishing the first book, you went on to work on Fire and Rain, which was published last year. Is that correct?
Seven, right at the beginning of
2023.
74.
Okay. And did the
I think
process
that's
of
right. Maybe I'm like, maybe it was 73.
that
Somewhere.
you started working
Last year and a half.
on? Okay. Yeah, so in the process of researching that, it was obviously about the Vietnam War, and you had protested against the Vietnam War during your time at Dartmouth. Do you think your views about that changed or became more nuanced as you researched the subject?
I think it became like it was never really a question. I thought that the Vietnam War was a catastrophe and should never have happened. And nothing that I ever learned since really altered that. But I was less interested in proving that it was bad, although then in explaining how it happened. And not like it just happened for 5 minutes, right? I mean, it went on and on. And when Richard and the Nixon period is really interesting because Tet Offensive had already happened. The US had been unsuccessful with 550,000 people there. There was a lot of reason, you know, why couldn't Richard Nixon have just said, this war, the Democrats have made a mess of it. They got us into it. They're conducting it stupidly. I'm getting us out of it. Goodbye. He didn't do that. You know, let another 4 years went by. So I was very interested in that issue, is how to understand how that happens. So that was one of the things. Oddly enough, a thing that I wasn't interested in, but then I got more interested in when I was started to reclassify documents, is the role of the peace movement. And partly I wanted to describe that for future generations, you know, something about what that was like. But oddly enough, it wasn't that much of a question in my mind, like, what was the impact of the peace movement? Weirdly, I wasn't exactly focused on that. But once I started to like read these documents, I realized the peace movement was way more influential in terms of what happened in the Nixon years than I had ever imagined. So that was like really fascinating to see that because it wasn't my preconception at all. And I think, if anything, it was a little bit of the opposite, which is feeling like the peace movement had been pretty unsuccessful. And so I actually changed about that. And then I had another, you know, so I had certain questions that were in my mind that were interesting me, other than wanting to convey to readers like what this was like, you know, what was this for? But then the other thing, and actually this is a little bit of a Dartmouth thing, because guy Jerry Danielle, who is my next door neighbor in Reed Hall, and we always had arguments. And the whole time I was there, he kept telling me over and over, "Don't you see that Nixon's a genius? Look what he's doing with China. Look what he's doing with Russia." We had this discussion a million times. And I was actually really interested in what was the relationship between the war in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and the diplomacy that Kissinger was carrying out with the Soviet Union and China. Like, I really wanted to understand that. And when I first started this project, Joan Huff Wilson, who's a very eminent historian, and I told her what I was interested in. She said, "You know, you're never going to see those transcripts. You'll never know. Don't even bother. Don't waste your time." But actually, they all became available, which took up another 5 years of my life reading them. But there, a lot of stuff emerged. So I actually spent a fair amount of time, you know, reading the transcripts, the negotiations with the Soviet Union and China, and trying to find a way to analyze that and to do it in a way that would not like put my audience to sleep, which was a challenge. So, you know, I had all these interests. Like, it wasn't like I'm writing a book to tell you how bad things were. I mean, which my book does show very clearly how bad things were. But that wasn't just, I didn't have that kind of a, you know, crusading spirit about what I really wanted to understand what was, how this could ever have happened. And that was just a lot of work. One other thing that I'll stop on my book, which is, you know, going to Vietnam was very consequential. Have you gone there yet, Nora, for one of your classes?
Oh, I'm hoping to in the future, but not yet.
I mean, it was so interesting to go. And, you know, and that, you know, I had set up in advance, I had countless interviews when I was in there. I was only there for months, but I interviewed like ridiculous amounts of people. And I feel like I learned so much from doing it. And it's not so much like, oh, this person said X. Although I did interview Madame Binh, who was I don't know if that means anything to you, but she was the head of the PRG delegation in Paris. And then when the North won, she became vice president of Vietnam. So I'd asked to meet her, and I didn't think anybody would say yes. And then I actually spent almost as much time with her as I'm spending with you. And she was very chatty. So that conversation was very revealing. But it wasn't even so much the conversations, it was like meeting people and seeing where things happened. And, you know, like, and suddenly think, first of all, I could figure out how things were, you know, oh, where's the Osho Valley? I don't know where it is. Well, actually, it is someplace. And what does it mean to go through the Osho Valley? And when you're saying that the Northern troops came down, I could picture, you know, how it could. At one point in my trip, I was being taken from the coast, almost from the coast of the South China Sea, across Vietnam, right to the Laotian border. And one of the people that was accompanying us was v has, had been as a kid Viet Cong. And as we're just driving along, you know, he's saying, "Oh, this is where we went. Let's stop here. I'll show you. This is when we went up with our bicycles." And then we, you know, it's like, so it was suddenly like reducing this mythical thing, you know, to human, you know, to human dimensions. And so I think just seeing it and lending some reality to this thing that if you were an American protester, you had your own stereotypical images. And then coming there and just seeing what it looked like. And, like one point we were in the Mekong Delta, and, and I mean, there are a million people in the Mekong Delta. It's incredibly dense. And like we're looking, my husband was with me. Nixon thought he was gonna like pacify this area. Like, really? That's what they, and seeing it was just like a whole thing. So, I feel like I learned a lot along the way.
And do you remember what date or year you traveled to Vietnam for
I
this?
feel like it was either, it was a while ago, it was early in this process. So I feel like it was maybe 2010.
Okay.
I think right now, actually, they're kind of in a period which is getting more repressive again. There's a lot of reasons for thinking that. But when we were there, I feel like it was pretty relaxed atmosphere. I mean, some of it was very poignant. Like at one point, because of the advice of this other journalist, Nick Turse, I asked to go to see Tainan Province, which is right on the border of Cambodia. And why did we go to that? Nick Turse said, go to Tainan, just like go there. It's like we're in this van. My husband said, why are we going to this place? And I said, I actually don't know. Nick told me to go. And so we go to Tainan Province, which is right on the border of Cambodia. And they had set up interviews. And we were only going to do this for like a day. And so we finished the interview. Somebody, they say, well, they'd like, people would like us to stay for dinner. And my husband was tired. And, so I asked our guide, like, should we stay for dinner? He said, of course you stay for dinner, you stupid people. So it turns out, like, the whole, they had made a banquet for us. A huge banquet. And then what was fascinating, I mean, people wanted to tell their stories. I mean, I ended up feeling very terrible about this because I felt like, what are you doing here? Like, people want to tell their stories and you don't have the time to listen. So I didn't love that. But just having people start telling, their stories to us, of what they had lived through. And just being in that whole atmosphere. And also, this sounds like really idiotic, but it's like they were real people. Like, there's some weird way, if you were in the anti-war movement, obviously you thought that they were real people, but you didn't know these real people. And so seeing these real people, I think it helped me to write, much better.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I guess to finish off the interview, you've occupied so many roles in the university, from being an undergraduate student to a graduate student to now being a professor, fulfilling your original vision of teaching foreign policy. So yeah, I guess in the current moment, what do you think you see as your role as a professor, in terms of engaging in politics in the university and interacting with students, has that changed at all?
Well, it's changed right now because the level of repression that's coming down is something that I had never encountered, I don't think existed before, of what's happening and the way in which anti-Semitism is being weaponized as a way to quash dissent. So you're in another land in terms of that. I mean, it honestly, that's bringing me back to junior high school when these advisors wouldn't let me write about the UN. I feel like it's just, except this is much more dangerous. And so, I mean, one of the things that is true right now is we're doing a lot of faculty organizing in support of our students. So that's taking time. And, we actually have pushed the administration. We just had a thing. The faculty's tried to push the administration into liberalizing. And the last meeting that they had with students, they seemed to be bending some rules. But like the students are planning to do a protest tomorrow, which happily I'm not on campus, but it'll be the test about whether the administration is going to be more liberal. So one part of my job, is that. I think, and a lot of other faculty are feel the same way. It's not, that we have a group. So that's a little different because I don't think I've ever had to really fight for the right of students to be able to express themselves. Like that's really different. One of the other ways I feel like it's different is I want the students in my class, first of all, to feel that they're capable of learning, which weirdly is they don't necessarily feel that way. And I want them to feel empowered that they, not in an idiotic way, but I want them to feel like the things that are going on outside the university, not just about Israel Palestine. I mean, as far as I could see, Trump is destroying the government right now. I mean, the level of damage that they're doing in 3 weeks is not to be believed. And what I'd like my students to feel, it's not like I don't want to bang in their head, you should think this versus that. But I would like them to feel, A, that the things that are going on around them are really significant, number one, and number two, that they have a role to play, whatever that is. I don't think faculty tell students what they're supposed to do, but that it doesn't, because right now, what's happening in Washington on my campus, I don't know if it's true at Dartmouth, I mean, except for Israel Palestine. What's happening in it's barely registering. I mean, the assault on the Constitution. I mean, those are kind of my goals. I like students to feel like they could, A, that they're responsible to know what's going on, B, that if they do try to learn, they could be competent, and that there's a lot of roles for them to play. If they once they got in their head that they could matter, then there's lots of things to do. And we started this 2 hours ago. Trying to I'm actually now losing the thread. Believe it or not, 3 hours and I'm whatever. I'd like them to feel that they matter and that they can do things. And I would say one thing that's a little bit different from Dartmouth, like if I was comparing the students I have now to the students I met in Dartmouth, I think in general that Dartmouth students have a much better sense of self, that they actually do feel more empowered in general. I wouldn't, go that far with it because whatever, but that their views matter, that their role is going to matter. I don't know that my students really feel that way. So that's kind of what I think part of my role is. I think I now actually lost you, if that's possible. Wait a
Oh,
minute.
I'm still here.
Wait, how have I lost you?
Can you
Maybe it's telling you that it was time to stop talking.
hear me? Okay, just resume the recording after some tech issues, but I think that's a great way to end the interview, thinking about how students do have a role and beyond just within the classroom and just learning and engaging in politics. So yeah, thank you so much, Professor Eisenberg, for speaking at length with me today. And yeah.
Thank you for being such a great listener. And one of the really nice things is meeting you. And I hope we'll actually meet again.
Of course, I'll end the recording here.